Good evening, and welcome again to Mission Dharma. Howie is away this week, and it's my honor to welcome as our guest teacher, Tom Moon. Tom is a psychotherapist in San Francisco. He's been practicing psychotherapy since 1978 and has been practicing mindfulness meditation since 1995. He's also a writer, and his column, The Examined Life, appears regularly in the San Francisco Bay Times. So thank you, Tom, for coming and sharing the Dharma with us tonight.
Thanks, Tara. So the subject I wanted to address tonight, which my partner calls my latest dharmatic preoccupation, is heartfulness, the practice of heartfulness. And it is a subject that's near and dear to my heart. And to introduce it, I would like it if you would participate in a little experiment with me. I know we've already meditated, but I'd like us to do it again. Only this time just for a minute. I'd like us to do 2 1-minute meditations. So we can all do that, right? And the experiment is, I'm going to give slightly different instructions for each meditation and just see what your experience is. Is it the same? Is it different? Okay? So, for the first one, for the next minute, close your eyes, sit quietly, anchor your attention on the breath, and be mindful of whatever arises. Okay, so open your eyes and come back into the room and just notice your state, notice what you're feeling, how that was. And now we'll do the second one. For the next minute, close your eyes, sit quietly, anchor your attention in the breath and open your heart to receive whatever arises. okay, come back into the room and just notice your state, notice what you're feeling. And I have no idea how this little experiment was going to go, but I would like to hear from a few people who might want to share what their experience was. Was it the same in both meditations? Was it different? And if so, how was it different? Just to hear from a few people, if anyone would like to talk. So in the first one, you were remembering the things that irritated you. In the second, a series of pleasant images. That's a pretty stark difference. I like that. Anyone else? More thought in the first one, more emotion in the second, and toward the end, more a sense of acceptance. Anyone else? Thank you. Over here.
In the first one, it felt sort of like regular meditation practice where my thoughts, when they wandered, were random. And then I was pulling myself back to the breath, and I was picturing what I always picture when I'm envisioning my breath going in and out. But when you said in the second meditation to envision it, as I am paraphrasing from your heart, instead of seeing
yes, great, thank you. One more. Oh, I'm sorry. Boy, if I summarizing that would be difficult. It was very, there was, oh, I don't know that I can do it. I'm having stage fright right now. The second one, there was more emotion in that one too, and including, feelings and thoughts that were emotionally connected. Is that? And the first one was more random, more scattered thoughts. I got it. Thank you. One more, sir? More vulnerability in the second one. Okay. Wow, this was a great experiment. I really, this is better than I thought. I mean, isn't this interesting? Because the only difference, really, between the two instructions were the words. Mindfulness versus, well, I said opening the heart, but mindfulness versus heartfulness. Just, and it's just the associations to the words that must have made the difference between the two meditations. And it sounded like people kind of liked the heartfulness one a little better, that something more happened or something more that they liked, that was more acceptance, more compassion, and so on. So this is really, really very interesting to me. I should say at the beginning that I'm not here to teach a new practice that's, stop doing mindfulness and do heartfulness, because the trick in this whole thing is that I think to many experienced practitioners, probably in this room, many will know that really the instructions are identical, right? In the Pali language, which is the closest language to what the Buddha spoke in, the term for mind and the term for heart are identical. They're not different. So when you give meditation instructions, you could speak of heartfulness or mindfulness or mind heartfulness or heart mindfulness. It doesn't really matter. They didn't have the idea that that we have had in this culture, that we think here and we feel here, you know. To many people, there are a lot of connotations to the word mindfulness. I discovered this when I was trying to teach it to psychotherapy patients who don't go on retreats and don't come to groups like this. And I noticed that the term mindfulness to them suggested something analytical, emotionless, detached, aloof, kind of indifferent. In fact, one of my patients a few months back informed me that the Buddhist answer to the problem of suffering was detachment. Detach from everything. That's the Buddhist solution. And I thought, yuck, you know. What a vision, you know, I'll be this aloof ego, separate from the world and completely unaffected by it. And I asked him, of course, who is the one who's going to detach, since he had heard that the Buddha also said there's no separate self to do that. But the connotations of the word mindfulness are very interesting, and I think they tend to lead people sometimes in a direction where they think they're just supposed to observe everything and detach and not care too much. And I think even experienced meditators, I will confess that I think that I went in that direction for a long time myself, and still do. But the term heartfulness sounds nicer. It sounds more friendly, more compassionate, more open and accepting. And it suggests a different attitude toward what arises in meditation than mindfulness does to many people. The term mindfulness is just a little didactic stuff for a second. Mindfulness is the English translation of the term sati from the Satipatthana Sutta, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, where the Buddha gives instructions on mindfulness practice. Sati really means something more like recollectedness, right? It refers to the sense of remembering when you become focused on the present, that sense of, oh yeah, I'm here, you know, that feeling. So mindfulness is the term we have, and I'm not on some kind of crusade to change the term. But I have been thinking more, and when I teach patients now in mindfulness practice, two things I don't do. I don't use the word meditate anymore, and I don't use the word, I use the word term heartfulness, or open the heart, or listen with the heart. And I find a lot less resistance to it. It's just very interesting to me. I think that this idea is really important for Americans. Because we're so hard on ourselves. Here's some questions that to think about. Am I on my own side? Not against other people, but am I consistently loyal to my own well-being and highest good? Am I self-forgiving and patient with myself when I make mistakes? Or am I more inclined to be angry and self-punitive? When I go through difficult times, do I respond to my own suffering with acceptance and self-compassion, or with self-blame and guilt? Do I regard myself as a close friend, or are there times when I treat myself as the enemy? I think these are interesting questions, and I think a lot of Americans will answer them in a fairly, you know, negative way. It seems like in this a competitive, individualistic culture, we've all got this inner critic, which is highly, looks at our performance in life and continually finds it lacking. Do you know what I'm talking about? Does anyone else have this besides me? Right? The inner critic? One of my friends calls it his butt-kicking machine. Here's Eckhart Tolle from The Power of Now. You have probably come across mad people in the street incessantly talking or muttering to themselves. Well, that's not much different from what you and all other so-called normal people do, except that you don't do it out loud. The voice comments, speculates, judges, compares, complains, likes, dislikes, and so on. It is not uncommon for the voice to be a person's own worst enemy. Many people live with a tormentor in their head that continuously attacks and punishes themselves and drains them of vital energy. It is the cause of untold misery and unhappiness, as well as disease. Anybody relate to that? I mean, I don't think he's exaggerating. I mean, I think that we are very hard. We are habitually very hard on ourselves. We can even use you get into the practice, and you can even use the Dharma against yourself, if you're so inclined. I mean, okay, the cause of suffering is attachment, clinging, grasping. But I know that, and I'm still doing it. So it's my own damn fault. I mean, so anyone ever thought that way? You can use the Dharma as a weapon against yourself. It's a common idea that many of us seem to have, that there must be some way to do life so that it isn't so hard, and that other people have it, and I haven't got it yet. And it's shameful that I don't have it, because I look around and I compare my insides to your outsides, and you all look like you're having a much easier time than I am, right? So it's very common for this sort of less than feeling to be there. I think most of us have it to some degree. And, you know, there have been, according to Rick Hansen, the neuropsychologist that some of you, I'm sure, know about, author of Buddha's Brain, the brains have been around on this planet for about 800 years, and 800 million years. I'm not a creationist. It's been a long time. 800 million years they've been evolving. And, you know, there's a momentum to that evolution. We've evolved to be anxious and wary of danger, and we've all evolved to be attached. We awaken in this predicament, if we're going to awaken at all, right? It isn't about us. It isn't my mind. It's the mind, right? Everybody's mind is pretty much alike. And then we have the social conditioning that we from our culture, and then we have the family conditioning, and then we, at some point in life, start practicing, and you've got the momentum of all this karma behind you, pushing you, is not your fault, you know? And it's really not about you in a fundamental sense. All we can do in the present moment is incline our minds, you know, toward peace in the present moment, toward acceptance, toward listening, toward compassion. And that's what practice is about. And that's our only freedom, is inclining the mind. But it's enough. Because it makes, I mean, I've seen it transform people immensely. So I've been talking about heartfulness. I don't think that I'm talking about anything different from what has been practiced. I actually think what I'm calling heartfulness is more like what Buddhists originally practiced and still do, you know, practitioners who have been doing it for many years. When I've talked about this with Howie, he knows exactly what I'm talking about. One thing he reminds me is you should remember that the heart is empty. This is not an entity. But other than that, this is not some new practice. Can we do another little heartfulness practice? I want to give you an example of kind of what I'm talking about. One of my big, one of the things I push a lot with people is mindful pauses. People say constantly, I just don't have the time to meditate. But most people can find the time to do a mindful pause, where in the middle of the day, you just recollect. You just take a couple of deep breaths, come into your body, and just notice what's here, right? Most people can do that. Thich Nhat Hanh recommends, if you're working at a desk, every time the phone rings, you think of that as the meditation bell, and you just take a deep breath. I don't know whether that would work in a lot of offices these days, but that's the kind of thing he talks about. A heartful pause is a little bit different. I would do it. You can do, when you're alone, especially. You can do this gesture. You can put your hand over your heart. You just might want to try that right now, and just feel the warmth of the hand on the heart, and just feel that your hand is sending the warmth of compassion into your heart. And then, with your eyes closed, there's some questions you can ask yourself. For instance, you can ask, what wants to be known right now? What wants to be accepted and loved? Then let go of the questions and listen with your heart to whatever arises. What I personally find when I do this practice, and maybe some other people would like to share what it's like, is that if I begin with the deliberate intention to be kind to myself, say doing a few metta phrases or doing this, my mindfulness is more steady because the attitude is more conducive to mindfulness. If I'm angry with myself, if I'm tight, if I'm angry at others, if I'm, whatever the afflictive emotions are, it's harder to be mindful. Openness, compassion, and so on are much more compatible with mindfulness. So that if I start with that intention, then my mind is going to be more steady. So I have taken to the, every time I do a session of mindfulness now, I always start with something like this or metta phrases. Would anyone like to share what that was like? Did anyone have an experience that they want to share? Sir? Just the awareness that I'm here, I'm seeing, and that's what I want. Kind of beautiful. So this is why I have been calling practice and thinking of it for myself as heartfulness lately. I think it works a little better for me than because I still have these associations that many people have to the term mindfulness. Again, I'm not on a crusade to change the word. One more little heartfulness practice, and then I'll stop and we can talk a little bit. Where is it? Okay, here it is. It's a little guided meditation that you can close your eyes for this one too. And this one I'll kind of talk at you a little bit. Pause for a moment and bring to mind the feeling of being with someone you know cares about you. Maybe a close friend, family member, even a pet. But a being who loves you or has loved you unconditionally. Let yourself feel that you matter to this being who wants you to feel good and do well in life. Now, bring to mind a difficulty or some suffering that you may be experiencing. And imagine that this being who cares about you is sending you waves of well wishes and compassion right into the center of your suffering. Not to change it, not to take it away, but is there with you in it, aware as you are of it. Let yourself bask in this compassion, taking in its warmth, concern, and goodwill. And open to feeling more understood and nurtured, more peaceful and settled. Then let go of the visualization. Let your friend go. And let yourself rest for a moment in pure awareness of what's here. Would anyone like to share a little bit about what that was like? The reason I think that this is such a powerful practice is that when I was talking about the negativity, the self-blame that is so common in our culture. What I forgot to say was that this is so automatic for many of us that it's below the radar. It's a habit. It's a practice, actually. Everything you think you're practicing. The neural pathways are laid down pretty deep for it. And so it's easy to go there without even being aware that you're doing it. So, when many of us sit down to meditate, one of the reasons meditation is difficult for many people is that we sit down and try to become aware of me or what I'm experiencing, and it's, you know, and that there is an attitude that we may not, that is so pervasive, so unconscious that you don't even know it's there, of criticism. Of negative, of not approving of what you're experiencing. We relate from that. And as long as we're that's in the background and we're relating from it, we don't become mindful of it. It's too habitual. It's like most of the time you're not aware of breathing, you know, or your heart beating. It's just happening. So to think of practice as heartfulness is to focus at the outset of the meditation on the attitude you're going to take towards your experience, forming the intention to be kind, compassionate, accepting toward all that arises. And that then makes it more possible when you see the inner critic to relate instead of from it, to relate to it. Start, you know, and to see, oh, there's the inner critic. There's that voice. And to send compassion and acceptance into the critic. You know, the critic's trying to help you. It's a weird thought. But the critic thinks that if he or she lets up on you for a second, you know, you're just going to sit on your butt on the couch for the rest of your life and not do anything. We believe we need to be hard on ourselves and discipline ourselves in order to shape up. Many of us do anyway, right? So the critic developed as an attempt for most of us to take care of ourselves. It's just not very effective. It tends to develop around the age of 5 or 6. So while it speaks with parental authority and can be very terrifying, it's a child's voice. That's why it speaks in absolutes. You never, you always, here you go. You know, it's not rational. So when that self-criticism begins to happen, if you've got a foundation of heartfulness, you can begin to see it and begin to examine it rather than be terrified of it. Most of us do this. We cringe when we hear the inner critic speaking to us. Am I making any sense here? So that's why I think, that's why I'm emphasizing in my own practice heartfulness. And why I think that it's a practice that can be very useful and can really aid, and how it helps make meditation easier. I think if you start with the intention to be compassionate and self-loving, the meditation will often be much easier. And so the idea that you can't meditate may help with that. The other reason that a lot of people think they can't meditate, of course, is that the mind is so unruly, and that's what I tried to address in the initial instructions, that if you do a mindful peek in the middle of a meditation when your mind is just all over the place, and if you look at other people, they all look like they're in formless samadhi, you know, they're all just, you know, but the secret is that everyone's minds are going every which way. It's pretty common. And so by not fighting the mind, again, by opening to it with compassion and acceptance, that was what the image of housebreaking the puppy was about. Then you begin to guide the mind without fighting with it. And you accept the mind for what it is. You know, as the Hindus say, it's monkey mind. It's jumping from tree to tree, chattering all the time. But that's its nature. That's how it evolved. And so there's an acceptance which is, I think, the foundation for meditation. Acceptance of what is arising in the present moment, even if it's not something you like. So we got about a few minutes for discussion or questions. Anyone who hasn't spoken yet want to say something, ask a question? No? Oh, back there.
Thank you.
Yes, I did. Yes. Yes. Right. Yes. Yes, that's beautiful. I personally was so just devastated by this. It felt like my heart was shattered at times. It felt like my heart was broken. But sometimes it felt like it was breaking open and I could feel compassion. Other times it was tighter than a fist. I was angry, you know, I especially at the politics in this country. We won't go into that right now, but I'm sure I wasn't the only one in this room who felt some of that. A lot of different feelings. What I think that practice ultimately does for us is we have all these surface waves of feelings and reactions that are intense, and the deeper you go, the more you find there is something in you, there's an inviolable spirit in you, so deep that no suffering of any kind can touch it. Not that it's aloof or far away. People call it impersonal, but it would only be impersonal in the sense that it's closer than personal. And that we all have a great heart. We all have Buddha nature. And no matter how horrendous, how terrific the suffering, there is some part of it, that sky-like nature, which can hold it. Not again in aloofness or indifference, but in deep love, and even in the midst of unbearable suffering.
What I keep coming back to is, although my first reaction when I read was deep sorrow, I also felt
I know. We're not alone, yes. I can't summarize all of that, but one of the things I think that I identify in what you said is that a horror like this also reminds us of the enormity of suffering all over the world that we can easily forget. I mean, imagine what it's like to be in Syria, you know, where these kinds of horrors are almost daily at this point in their history. I mean, it's unimaginable. And to open to that suffering is difficult to do. It's easy to forget, to pull away. And I think heartfulness practice is what helps us to open to these things. I'm going to stop here. We're just about out of time. And I think Tara wanted to... I want to thank you for being with me and for letting me share my current preoccupation. And I think Tara wanted to say something.
Yeah, so just a couple of announcements before the Donna talk. Tom has a sign-up for his The Examined Life email in the back on the community table, if you'd like to sign up for that. And so next week, Tuesday, is there won't be any Mission Dharma for Christmas Day. But Howie will be here on New Year's Day to ring in the new year with us. And so Tom offered his teachings tonight freely in a spirit of generosity, as all the teachings here at Mission Dharma are offered freely, in keeping with a 2,500-year-old Buddhist tradition. And the space is also offered freely to all of us each week. You're welcome to offer your generosity in the Donna baskets. There's one by the door and one on the organ bench right here. You can offer Teacher Donna, Donna towards the room rental. And if you want to make a tax-deductible donation, you can fill out a check to St. John the Evangelist Church with Mission Dharma in the memo line. And have heartful holidays. Thank you, everyone, for listening.
Somebody's watch. Hi.